and a woolen blanket to warm her bed on a cold night.
Charlotte's reply was spared by the entrance of Jane and Elizabeth.
Aye, there she comes, continued Mrs. Bennet, looking as unconcerned as may be, and caring no more for us than if we were the very unmentionables she takes such pleasure in occupying her time with. But I tell you, Miss Lizzie, if you take it into your head to go on refusing every offer of marriage in this way, you may as well run me through with one of your silly Oriental swords, for to see one's daughter unmarried is a fate worse than death.
Chapter 21 The discussion of Mr. Collins's offer was now nearly at an end. The gentleman himself scarcely spoke to her, and his assiduous attentions were transferred for the rest of the day to Miss Lucas, whose civility in listening to him was a seasonable relief to them all, and especially to her friend. Indeed, Charlotte seemed to flatter Mr. Collins with an almost unnatural attentiveness. The morrow produced no abatement of Mrs. Bennet's ill-humour or ill-health. Mr. Collins was also in the same state of angry pride. Elizabeth had hoped that his resentment might shorten his visit, but his plan did not appear in the least affected by it. He was always to have gone on Saturday, and to Saturday he meant to stay. After breakfast, the girls retired to the dojo and attended to their midweek musket disassembly and cleaning. With those very weapons on their person, they next set out for Meryton to inquire if Mr. Wickham were returned, and to lament over his absence from the Netherfield ball. They were less than a mile from Longbourn when Kitty, who had elected to take point, abruptly stopped and signalled for the others to do so as well. She raised her musket, but at what, Elizabeth and the other girls knew not, for the road seemed free of trouble. After standing thus for a moment, a single chipmunk scurried out of the woods on their right. It darted across their path with considerable rapidity before disappearing into the woods on the left. Lydia could not help but laugh at the sight.
"My dear Kitty, how shall we ever thank you for sparing our toes a most unfortunate tickling?"
But Kitty kept her musket at the ready, and after a moment a second chipmunk scurried across the road with equal alacrity. It was followed in short order by a pair of weasels, then a skunk, then a fox and her pups. More creatures followed, and in ever-increasing numbers, as if Noah himself beckoned, offering refuge from some unseen flood. By the time deer began to leap across their path, the other girls had their muskets trained on the tree line, ready for the herd of zombies they suspected would appear at any moment. The first was a young, freshly dead female in a white lace wedding gown, which, like her skin, was surprisingly white, almost shockingly so, save for the bright red rubies that dripped from her mouth and onto the lace covering her bosom. Kitty put the creature down with a shot to the face, upon which Lydia placed her barrel against its head and promptly dispatched it to hell. So close was this shot that the bride's hair was set alight by the powder flash.
"Seems a shame," said Lydia, as acrid smoke began to rise. "Wasting perfectly good wedding clothes like that."
The wail of another zombie interrupted her, his flowing white beard and half-eaten face attached to a stout body which was clad in a blood-crusted blacksmith's apron. Elizabeth and Jane aimed and discharged their muskets, Jane's ball finding one of the creature's eyes, and Elizabeth's striking its neck, cutting through the brittle flesh and separating head from body. These zombies were followed by several more, each vanquished as quickly as the last, until the cracking of powder at last fell silent. Sensing the danger past, the sisters lowered their barrels and spoke of setting off again for Meryton. But these plans were belated by a most unusual noise from beyond the tree line. It was a shrill shrieking, neither human nor animal, and yet unlike any zombie wail the sisters had ever heard. It grew closer, and once again all muskets were trained and readied. But when the source of this strange noise revealed itself, their barrels were lowered.
"Oh, no," said Jane. "Oh, it simply cannot be."
A long-dead female zombie stumbled out of the woods, her modest clothing slightly tattered, her brittle hair pulled back so tightly that it had begun to tear the skin of her forehead. In her arms she held something exceedingly rare, something none of the sisters had ever seen or ever wished to see, an unmentionable infant. It clawed at the female's flesh, emitting a most unpleasant series of shrieks. Elizabeth raised her musket, but Jane was quick to grab the barrel. "You mustn't! Have you forgotten your oath? It's an infant, Lizzie!" "A zombie infant! No more alive than the musket I mean to silence it with!" Elizabeth again raised her weapon and aimed. The female dreadful was now more than halfway across the road. She trained her sights on the elder's head, her finger caressing the trigger. She would put it down, reload, and dispense of them both. All she had to do was squeeze. And yet, she did not. There was a strange force at work, a feeling she faintly recalled from her earliest days, before she had first travelled to Shaolin. It was a curious feeling, something akin to shame, but without the dishonour of defeat. A shame that demanded no vengeance. Could there be honour in mercy? She wondered. It contradicted everything she had been taught, every warrior instinct she possessed. Why, then, could she not fire? Hopelessly bemused, Elizabeth lowered her musket, and the zombies continued into the woods until they were seen no more. It was agreed that none of them would ever speak of it. Wickham joined the sisters on their entering the town and attended them to their aunt's, where his regret and vexation and concern upon hearing of the regrettable fate of Mr. Bingley's household staff was well talked over. To Elizabeth, however, he voluntarily acknowledged that the necessity of his absence had been self-imposed. "I found," said he, "as the time drew near, that I had better not meet Mr. Darcy, that to be in the same room with the very man who crippled me for a twelvemonth might be more than I could bear, and that scenes might arise unpleasant to more than myself." Elizabeth highly approved his forbearance, which was greater than her own, for she confessed that a duel would have almost certainly ensued had she been in his place. Wickham and another officer walked back with them to Longbourn, and during the walk he particularly attended to her. His accompanying them was a triple advantage: the compliment of his attention, an occasion of introducing him to her mother and father, and the presence of an extra warrior should they encounter trouble on the road. Soon after their return, a letter was delivered to Miss Bennet. It came from Netherfield. The envelope contained a sheet of elegant little hot-pressed paper, well covered with a lady's fair, flowing hand, and Elizabeth saw her sister's countenance change as she read it, and saw her dwelling intently on some particular passages. "This is from Caroline Bingley. What it contains has surprised me a good deal. The whole party have left Netherfield by this time, and are on their way to town, and without any intention of coming back again. You shall hear what she says." She then read the first sentence aloud, which comprised the information of their having just resolved to follow their brother to town directly, and of their meaning to dine in Grosvenor Square, where Mr. Hurst had a house. The next was in these words: "I do not pretend to regret anything I shall leave in the perilous, zombie-covered country, except your society, my dearest friend. But we will hope, at some future period, to enjoy many returns of that delightful intercourse we have known, and in the meanwhile may lessen the pain of separation by a very frequent and most unreserved correspondence. I depend on you for that." To these high-flown expressions Elizabeth listened with all the insensibility of distrust, and though the suddenness of their removal surprised her, she saw nothing to lament. "It is unlucky," said she, "that you should not be able to see your friends before they leave the country. But may we not hope that the period of future happiness to which Miss Bingley looks forward may arrive earlier than she is aware, and that the delightful intercourse you have known as friends will be renewed with yet greater satisfaction as sisters? Mr. Bingley will not be detained in London by them. Caroline decidedly says that none of the party will return into Hertfordshire this winter. I will read it to you. When my brother left us yesterday, he imagined that the business which took him to London might be concluded in 3 or 4 days, but we are certain it cannot be so. Many of my acquaintances are already there for the winter. I wish that I could hear that you, my dearest friend, had any intention of making one of the crowd, but of that I despair. I sincerely hope your Christmas in Hertfordshire may abound in the gaieties which that season generally brings, and be not the least bit similar to the Christmas of 2 years past, which resulted in so many unpleasantries. It is evident by this, added Jane, that he comes back no more this winter.
It is only evident that Miss Bingley does not mean that he should, said Elizabeth.
Mr. Bingley is his own master. Perhaps the sight of his bloodied staff was too much for his delicate character. But you do not know all. I will read you the passage which particularly hurts me. Mr. Darcy is impatient to see his sister, and we are scarcely less eager to meet her again. I really do not think Georgiana Darcy has her equal for beauty, elegance, and skill in the deadly arts, and the affection she inspires in Louisa and myself is heightened from the hope we dare entertain of her being hereafter our sister. My brother admires her greatly already. He will have frequent opportunity now of seeing her on the most intimate footing. With all these circumstances to favour an attachment, and nothing to prevent it, am I wrong, my dearest Jane, in indulging the hope of an event which will secure the happiness of so many? What do you think of this sentence, my dear Lizzie? Said Jane as she finished it. Is it not clear enough? Does it not expressly declare that Caroline neither expects nor wishes me to be her sister, that she is perfectly convinced of her brother's indifference, and that if she suspects the nature of my feelings for him, she means, most kindly, to put me on my guard? Can there be any other opinion on the subject? Yes, there can, for mine is totally different. Will you hear it? Most willingly. You shall have it in a few words. Miss Bingley sees that her brother is in love with you and wants him to marry Miss Darcy. I dare say she means to keep you from his attentions. Your honour demands she be slain. Jane shook her head.
You forget yourself, Lizzie.
Jane, no one who has ever seen you together can doubt his affection. Miss Bingley, I am sure, cannot.
She may not be a warrior, but she has cunning enough. Dearest sister, I implore you. This unhappiness is best remedied by the hasty application of a cutlass to her throat.
If we thought alike, replied Jane, my honour would be restored at the expense of losing Mr. Bingley's affections forever. And what, pray, would be the purpose? Caroline is incapable of wilfully deceiving anyone, and all that I can hope in this case is that she is deceiving herself.
Is it she who is deceived, or you? You forget yourself, Jane. You have allowed your feelings for Mr. Bingley to soften the instincts bestowed by our Oriental masters. Though they could not agree on a course of action, Jane and Elizabeth agreed that Mrs. Bennet should only hear of the departure of the family, but even this partial communication gave her a great deal of concern, and she bewailed it as exceedingly unlucky that the ladies should happen to go away just as they were all getting so intimate together. After lamenting it, however, at some length, she had the consolation that Mr. Bingley would soon be down again, and soon dining at Longbourn, and the conclusion of all was the comfortable declaration that, though he had been invited only to a family dinner, she would take care to have 2 full courses.
Chapter 22 The Bennets were engaged to dine with the Lucases, and again, during the chief of the day, was Miss Lucas so kind as to listen to Mr. Collins. Elizabeth took an opportunity of thanking her. "It keeps him in good humour," said she, "and I am more obliged to you than I can express." This was very amiable, but Charlotte's kindness extended farther than Elizabeth had any conception of. Its object was nothing else than to secure her from any return of Mr. Collins's proposals by engaging them towards herself. Such was Miss Lucas's scheme, and appearances were so favourable that when they parted at night she would have felt almost secure of success, if he had not been to leave Hertfordshire so very soon. But here she did injustice to the fire and independence of his character, for it led him to escape out of Longbourn House the next morning with admirable slyness, and hasten to Lucas Lodge to throw himself at her feet. He was anxious to avoid the notice of his cousins, from a conviction that if they saw him depart, they could not fail to conjecture his design, and he was not willing to have the attempt known till its success might be known likewise. For though feeling almost secure, and with reason, for Charlotte had been tolerably encouraging, he was comparatively diffident since the adventure of Elizabeth's rejection. His reception, however, was of the most flattering kind. Miss Lucas perceived him from an upper window as he walked towards the house, and instantly set out to meet him accidentally in the lane. But little had she dared to hope that so much love and eloquence awaited her there. In as short a time as Mr. Collins's long speeches would allow, everything was settled between them to the satisfaction of both. And as they entered the house, he earnestly entreated her to name the day that was to make him the happiest of men. Sir William and Lady Lucas were speedily applied to for their consent, and it was bestowed with a most joyful alacrity. For each felt it was a miracle that any man would find their plain, astonishingly old daughter fetching in the slightest. Mr. Collins's present circumstances made it a most eligible match for their daughter, to whom they could give little fortune, and his prospects of future wealth were exceedingly fair. Lady Lucas began directly to calculate, with more interest than the matter had ever excited before, how many years longer Mr. Bennet was likely to live, and Sir William gave it as his decided opinion that whenever Mr. Collins should be in possession of the Longbourn estate, it would be highly expedient that both he and his wife should take up residence and dispense of the unsightly dojo post-haste. The whole family, in short, were properly overjoyed on the occasion. The least agreeable circumstance in the business was the surprise it must occasion to Elizabeth Bennet, whose friendship Charlotte valued beyond that of any other person. Would she disapprove? Would she strike out in anger and cut Charlotte down? Or worse, would she have no desire of further acquaintance? Charlotte resolved to give her the information herself, and therefore charged Mr. Collins, when he returned to Longbourn to dinner, to drop no hint of what had passed before any of the family. A promise of secrecy was, of course, very dutifully given, but it could not be kept without difficulty, for the curiosity excited by his long absence burst forth in such very direct questions on his return as required some ingenuity to evade. As he was to begin his journey too early on the morrow to see any of the family, the ceremony of leave-taking was performed when the ladies moved for the night, and Mrs. Bennet, with great politeness and cordiality, said how happy they should be to see him at Longbourn again, whenever his engagements might allow him to visit them. "My dear madam," he replied, "this invitation is particularly gratifying, because it is what I have been hoping to receive, and you may be very certain that I shall avail myself of it as soon as possible." They were all astonished, and Mr. Bennet, who would have preferred being eaten alive by a herd of the undead to the speedy return of Mr. Collins, immediately said, "But is there not danger of Lady Catherine's disapprobation here, my good sir? You had better neglect your relations than run the risk of offending your patroness, for she has been known to express her disapproval in the most horrid manner." "My dear sir," replied Mr. Collins, "I am particularly obliged to you for this friendly caution, and you may depend upon my not taking so material a step without her ladyship's concurrence." "You cannot be too much upon your guard. Risk anything rather than her displeasure, and if you find it likely to be raised by your coming to us again, which I should think exceedingly probable, be satisfied that we shall take no offence, for we have little use for a headless guest. Believe me, my dear sir, my gratitude is warmly excited by such affectionate attention, and depend upon it, you will speedily receive from me a letter of thanks for this and for every other mark of your regard during my stay in Hertfordshire. As for my fair cousins, I shall now take the liberty of wishing them health and happiness, not excepting my cousin Elizabeth." Elizabeth had been expecting such a slight, and determined to show not the least offence at it, lest he gain some measure of victory over her. She instead smiled and said, "And I, Mr. Collins, wish you the safest of journeys, for there have been such an uncommon number of dreadfuls on the roads of late that an encounter seems unavoidable. I am certain, however, that yours will be the exception." With proper civilities, the ladies then withdrew, all of them equally surprised that he meditated a quick return. Mrs. Bennet wished to understand by it that he thought of paying his addresses to one of her younger girls, and Mary might have been prevailed on to accept him. But on the following morning every hope of this kind was done away. Miss Lucas called soon after breakfast, and in a private conference with Elizabeth related the event of the day before. The possibility of Mr. Collins's fancying himself in love with her friend had once occurred to Elizabeth within the last day or two, but that Charlotte could encourage him seemed almost as far from possibility as she could encourage him herself.
"Engaged to Mr. Collins? My dear Charlotte, impossible!"
Miss Lucas calmly replied,
"Why should you be surprised, my dear Eliza?
Do you think it incredible that Mr. Collins should be able to procure any woman's good opinion because you thought him ill-suited to be the husband of so great a woman as yourself?" Such an affront would have been met with fists had it come from any other person, but in this case Elizabeth's affections were greater even than her honour. Seeing no hope of persuading her otherwise, she wished Charlotte all imaginable happiness.
"I see what you are feeling," replied Charlotte. "You must be surprised, very much surprised, so lately as Mr. Collins was wishing to marry you. But when you have had time to think it over, I hope you will be satisfied with what I have done. I am not romantic, you know, I never was. I ask only a comfortable home, and considering Mr. Collins's character, connection, and situation in life, I am convinced that my chance of happiness with him is as fair as most people can boast on entering the marriage state, especially since... Oh, Elizabeth, I beg you will not be angry with me or cut me down where I stand. But, Elizabeth, I can have no secrets from you. I have been stricken."
Elizabeth gasped. Her closest friend stricken by the plague, condemned to serve Satan. Her instincts demanded she back away. She listened as Charlotte recounted the unhappy event which occurred during her Wednesday walk to Longbourn. Daring to make the trip alone and unarmed, she had hastened upon the road undisturbed, until she happened upon an overturned chaise and four. Seeing no unmentionables about, Charlotte approached and knelt, readying her eyes to meet the gruesome visage of a crushed coachman. To her horror, she was instead met by the grasp of a zombie who had been trapped beneath the carriage. Her leg caught in its bony fingers, she screamed as the creature's teeth broke her skin. She was able to free herself and continue to Longbourn, but hell's dark business had been carried out.
"I don't have long, Elizabeth. All I ask is that my final months be happy ones, and that I be permitted a husband who will see to my proper Christian beheading and burial."
Chapter 23. Elizabeth was sitting with her mother and sisters, reflecting on what she had heard, and resolving to speak of it to no one, when Sir William Lucas himself appeared, sent by his daughter, to announce her engagement to the family. With many compliments to them, he unfolded the matter, to an audience not merely wondering but incredulous. For Mrs. Bennet, with more perseverance than politeness, protested he must be entirely mistaken, and Lydia, always unguarded and often uncivil, boisterously exclaimed,
"Good Lord! Sir William, how can you tell such a story? Do not you know that Mr. Collins wants to marry Lizzie?"
Thankfully, Sir William had been trained as a tailor and not a warrior, for nothing less than the patience of a man who had threaded 10,000 needles could have borne such treatment without anger. Elizabeth, feeling it incumbent on her to relieve him from so unpleasant a situation, now put herself forward to confirm his account by mentioning her prior knowledge of it from Charlotte herself. Mrs. Bennet was too much overpowered to say a great deal while Sir William remained, but no sooner had he left them than her feelings found a rapid vent.
In the first place, she persisted in disbelieving the whole of the matter. Secondly, she was very sure that Mr. Collins had been taken in. Thirdly, she trusted that they would never be happy together. And fourthly, that the match might be broken off.
Two inferences, however, were plainly deduced from the whole. One, that Elizabeth was the real cause of the mischief, and the other that she herself had been barbarously misused by them all, and on these two points she principally dwelt during the rest of the day. Nothing could console and nothing could appease her, nor did that day wear out her resentment. She resigned herself to fuming in bed with a wet washcloth and her sick bucket. Mr. Bennet's emotions were much more tranquil on the occasion, for it gratified him, he said, to discover that Charlotte Lucas, whom he had been used to think tolerably sensible, was as foolish as his wife, and more foolish than his daughter. As for Elizabeth, she could hardly think on the matter without coming to tears, for she alone knew the sorrowful truth. She thought often of striking Charlotte down, of donning her tarby boots and slipping into her bedchamber under cover of darkness, where she would mercifully end her friend's misery with the panther's kiss. But she had given her word, and her word was sacred. She would not interfere with Charlotte's transformation. Her grief for Charlotte made her turn with fonder regard to her sister, for whose happiness she grew daily more anxious, as Bingley had now been gone a week, and nothing more was heard of his return. Jane had sent Caroline an early answer to her letter, and was counting the days till she might reasonably hope to hear again. The promised letter of thanks from Mr. Collins, whose journey had been, against Elizabeth's hopes, unencumbered by zombies, arrived on Tuesday, addressed to their father, and written with all the solemnity of gratitude which a 12 months' abode in the family might have prompted. After discharging his conscience on that head, he proceeded to inform them of his happiness in having obtained the affection of their amiable neighbour, Miss Lucas, and then explained that it was merely with the view of enjoying her society that he had been so ready to close with their kind wish of seeing him again at Longbourn, whither he hoped to be able to return on Monday fortnight. For Lady Catherine, he added, so heartily approved his marriage that she wished it to take place as soon as possible, which he trusted would be an unanswerable argument with his amiable Charlotte to name an early day for making him the happiest of men. Elizabeth could not help but feel for the poor fat fool. He had no idea what misery awaited. Mr. Collins's return into Hertfordshire was no longer a matter of pleasure to Mrs. Bennet. On the contrary, she was as much disposed to complain of it as her husband. It was very strange that he should come to Longbourn instead of Lucas Lodge. It was also very inconvenient and exceedingly troublesome. She hated having visitors in the house while her health was so indifferent, and lovers were of all people the most disagreeable. Such were the gentle murmurs of Mrs. Bennet, and they gave way only to the greater distress of Mr. Bingley's continued absence. An hour seldom passed in which she did not talk of Bingley, express her impatience for his arrival, or even require Jane to confess that if he did not come back she would think herself very ill-used. It needed all Jane's training under Master Lure to bear these attacks with tolerable tranquillity. Mr. Collins returned most punctually on Monday fortnight, but his reception at Longbourn was not quite so gracious as it had been on his first introduction. He was too happy, however, to need much attention, and luckily for the others, the business of love-making relieved them from a great deal of his company. The chief of every day was spent by him at Lucas Lodge, and he sometimes returned to Longbourn only in time to make an apology for his absence before the family went to bed. Mrs. Bennet was really in a most pitiable state. The very mention of anything concerning the match threw her into a vomiting fit, and wherever she went she was sure of hearing it talked of. The sight of Miss Lucas was odious to her, as it had been to many a gentleman in times past. As her successor in that house, she regarded her with jealous abhorrence. Whenever Charlotte came to see them, she concluded her to be anticipating the hour of possession, and whenever she spoke in a low voice to Mr. Collins, was convinced that they were talking of the Longbourn estate, and resolving to turn herself and her daughters out of the house as soon as Mr. Bennet were dead. She complained bitterly of all this to her husband. "Indeed, Mr. Bennet," said she, "it is very hard to think that Charlotte Lucas should ever be mistress of this house, that I should be forced to make way for her, and live to see her take her place in it." "My dear, do not give way to such gloomy thoughts. Let us hope for better things. Let us flatter ourselves that Mr. Collins, who seems always eager to talk of heaven, may be dispatched there by a horde of zombies before I am dead. Chapter 24. Miss Bingley's letter arrived and put an end to doubt. The very first sentence conveyed the assurance of their being all settled in London for the winter, and concluded with her brother's regret at not having had time to pay his respects to his friends in Hertfordshire before he left the country. Hope was over, entirely over, and when Jane could attend to the rest of the letter, she found little, except the professed affection of the writer, that could give her any comfort. Miss Darcy's praise occupied the chief of it. Her many attractions were again dwelt on, her unmatched skill with blade and bludgeon, her supple, pleasing form, and the authenticity of her Japanese. Elizabeth, to whom Jane very soon communicated the chief of all this, heard it in silent indignation. Her heart was divided between concern for her sister and thoughts of going immediately to town and dispensing of the lot of them. The teacup she had been holding presently shattered into small pieces in her hand. "My dear Jane," exclaimed Elizabeth, "you are too good. Your sweetness and disinterestedness are really angelic. You wish to think all the world respectable, and are hurt if I speak of killing anybody for any reason. Do not be afraid of my running into any excess, of my encroaching on your privilege of universal goodwill. You need not. There are few people whom I really love, and still fewer of whom I think well. The more I see of the world, the more I am dissatisfied with it, and every zombie confirms my belief that God has abandoned us as punishment for the evils of people such as Miss Bingley. My dear Lizzie, do not give way to such feelings as these. They will ruin your happiness. You do not make allowance enough for difference of situation and temper. For someone who so often speaks of our dear master, I fear you have forgotten much of his wisdom. Were we not taught to temper our feelings? We must not be so ready to fancy ourselves intentionally injured. It is very often nothing but our own vanity that deceives us. I am far from attributing any part of Mr. Bingley's conduct to design, said Elizabeth. But without scheming to do wrong or to make others unhappy, there may be error and there may be misery. Thoughtlessness, want of attention to other people's feelings, and want of resolution— grave offences to one's honour all. And do you impute it to either of those? Yes, to the last. But if I go on, I shall displease you by saying what I think of persons you esteem. Stop me whilst you can. You persist, then, in supposing his sisters influence him. I believe it so ardently as to offer you my sword in their vanquishing. I cannot believe it. Why should they try to influence him? They can only wish his happiness, and if he is attached to me, no other woman can secure it. Your first position is false. They may wish many things besides his happiness. They may wish his increase of wealth and consequence. They may wish him to marry a girl who has all the importance of money, great connections, and pride. Beyond a doubt, they do wish him to choose Miss Darcy, replied Jane. But this may be from better feelings than you are supposing. They have known her much longer than they have known me. No wonder if they love her better. But whatever may be their own wishes, it is very unlikely they should have opposed their brothers. What sister would think herself at liberty to do it? If they believed him attached to me, they would not try to part us. If he were so, they could not succeed. By supposing such an affection, you make everybody acting unnaturally and wrong, and me most unhappy. Do not distress me by the idea. I am not ashamed of having been mistaken. Let me take it in the best light. Elizabeth could scarcely contain her anger. Still, Jane was her elder and leader of the sisters Bennet. She had no choice but to obey. From this time, Mr. Bingley's name was scarcely ever mentioned between them. Mrs. Bennet still continued to wonder and repine at his returning no more, and though a day seldom passed in which Elizabeth did not account for it clearly, there was little chance of her ever considering it with less perplexity. Mrs. Bennet's best comfort was that Mr. Bingley must be down again in the summer. Mr. Bennet treated the matter differently. "So, Lizzie," said he one day, "your sister is crossed in love, I find.
I congratulate her.
Next to being married, a girl likes to be crossed a little in love now and then. It is something to think of, and it gives her a sort of distinction among her companions. When is your turn to come? You will hardly bear to be long outdone by Jane. Now is your time. Here are officers enough in Meryton to disappoint all the young ladies in the country. Let Wickham be your man. He is a pleasant fellow, and might teach you something of those wifely parts of life which you, above all your sisters, have forsaken."
"Thank you, sir, but I am perfectly content being the bride of death. We must not all expect Jane's good fortune."
"True," said Mr. Bennet, "but it is a comfort to think that whatever of that kind may befall you, you have an affectionate mother who will make the most of it."
Chapter 25.
After a week spent in professions of love and schemes of felicity, Mr. Collins was called from his amiable Charlotte by the arrival of Saturday. He took leave of his relations at Longbourn with as much solemnity as before, wished his fair cousins health and happiness again, and promised their father another letter of thanks. On the following Monday, Mrs. Bennet had the pleasure of receiving her brother and his wife, who came as usual to spend the Christmas at Longbourn. Mr. Gardiner was a sensible, gentlemanlike man, greatly superior to his sister, as well by nature as education. The Netherfield ladies would have had difficulty in believing that a man who lived by trade, and within view of his own warehouses, could have been so well-bred and agreeable. Mrs. Gardiner, who was several years younger than Mrs. Bennet, was an amiable, intelligent, elegant woman, and a great favourite with all her Longbourn nieces. Between the two eldest and herself especially, there subsisted a particular regard. She had often provided encouragement to continue their training when it had become too severe, and provided refuge when their mother's derision of their savage nature became intolerable. The first part of Mrs. Gardiner's business on her arrival was to distribute her presents and describe the goings-on in town. She spoke of subjects as diverse as new fashions and recent victories against the sorry-stricken. When this was done, she had a less active part to play. It became her turn to listen. Mrs. Bennet had many grievances to relate and much to complain of. They had all been very ill-used since she last saw her sister. Two of her girls had been upon the point of marriage, and after all, there was nothing in it. "I do not blame Jane," she continued, "for Jane would have got Mr. Bingley if she could. But Lizzie, oh, sister, it is very hard to think that she might have been Mr. Collins's wife by this time had her mind not been poisoned by those Chinese devils. He made her an offer in this very room, and she refused him. The consequence of it is that Lady Lucas will have a daughter married before I have, and that the Longbourn estate is just as much entailed as ever. The Lucases are very artful people indeed, sister. They are all for what they can get. I am sorry to say it of them, but so it is." Mrs. Gardiner, to whom the chief of this news had been given before, in the course of Jane and Elizabeth's correspondence with her, made her sister a slight answer, and in compassion to her nieces, turned the conversation to more pleasing subjects, such as the fire that had recently claimed the lives of 400 innocent children in town. When alone with Elizabeth afterwards, she spoke more on the subject. "It seems likely to have been a desirable match for Jane," said she. "I am sorry it went off, but these things happen so often. A young man, such as you describe Mr. Bingley, so easily falls in love with a pretty girl for a few weeks, and when accident separates them, so easily forgets her. I implore you to believe me, Lizzie, for I relate this intelligence from my own experience. By the time I was your age, I had been courted and cast off by scores of young men."
"An excellent consolation in its way," said Elizabeth. "But it will not do for us. It does not often happen that the interference of friends will persuade a young man of independent fortune to think no more of a girl whom he was violently in love with only a few days before. Pray, how violent was Mr. Bingley's love?
as violent as the monks of Dragon Mountain. Every time they met, it was more decided and remarkable. Poor Jane. I am sorry for her, because with her disposition, she may not get over it immediately. It had better have happened to you, Lizzie. You would have opened this Bingley's stomach and strangled him with his own bowels, I suspect. Do you think she would be prevailed upon to go back to town with us? Change of scene might be of service, and perhaps a little relief from home may be as useful as anything. Elizabeth was exceedingly pleased with this proposal, and felt persuaded of her sister's ready acquiescence. It was too long since her eyes had been filled with the delights of London, which, though quarantined by towering walls and divided into sections by the King's army, was still a city unrivalled in its ability to excite the senses. "I hope," added Mrs. Gardiner, "that no consideration with regard to this young man will influence her. We go out so little that it is very improbable that they should meet at all, unless he comes to see her. And that is quite impossible, for he is now in the custody of his friend, and Mr. Darcy would no more suffer him to call on Jane in Section 6 East. So much the better. I hope they will not meet at all." Christmas morning came, and with it a blanket of snow, which was welcomed more for the added protection it offered against degraving than for its beauty. All of the usual pleasantries were exchanged, along with gifts and sweets for the Gardiner children. As was his custom, Mr. Bennet presented each of his daughters with a weapon of his own creation. To Jane he gave a set of hand-carved throwing stars, each in the shape of the letter J. To Elizabeth, a new Brown Bess, which he had altered by adding two additional barrels on either side of the original. To Mary, a long bow fashioned from the spine of a carriage horse. To Lydia, a small pair of nunchucks suited to her delicate hands. And to Kitty, a dagger with a pearl handle, something she had begged for since the tender age of 4. It was before breakfast, while the sisters were sparring gleefully in the snow with their new weapons, when Lydia noticed a dozen or so visitors walking over the hill from Meryton. Judging by their number, their songbooks, and their Christmas best, it was the Helfords.
"What a delightful surprise!" cried Kitty. "Do you think they mean to carol for us?"
It was a silly question, even for Kitty. The Helfords had come to carol for them every Christmas morning since Jane was but an infant. Victoria, the eldest daughter, had been a friend of the Bennet girls the whole of her life, despite being unlearned in the ways of administering death. She was fond of Jane in particular, for both had a propensity for seeing the best in others. Indeed, all of the Helfords, save one, had a pleasant way about them, even in the face of England's unhappiness. Only their eldest daughter, Missy, escaped unanimous praise, for she was something of a plain, humourless girl, and thus the favourite of Mary. For Elizabeth, the warmth and cheer of Mrs. Helford had served as a refuge from her own mother's ceaseless prattling and dour disposition. The sisters Bennet ceased their sparring and lined up to welcome their neighbours.
"Strange," said Lizzie. "I've always known them to approach in song."
As the family grew nearer, however, Elizabeth's spirits began to sink. For instead of singing, the Helfords' voices were joined in a chorus of strange noise, a noise very much like moaning.
"It cannot be."
All 12 of the Helfords were stricken, their cheerful Christmas best tattered and their songbooks partially eaten. Even the youngest boy, aged 5 years, had enlisted in Satan's army, his face expressionless and his eyes as white as the snow he presently stumbled through.
"Oh, sweet, sweet Helfords," cried Mary, her face already wet with despondency.
"Your tears are of no use, stupid girl," cried Elizabeth.
"Oh, Lizzie," sobbed Jane, "if you censure Mary, you may as well censure all of us, for we cannot help but weep at such a sorry sight."
Indeed, all of Elizabeth's sisters were in tears. The Helfords had already reached the dojo and would soon be within biting distance of the house. Seeing her sisters thus affected, Elizabeth took Kitty's pearl-handled dagger from her trembling hands and, addressing all of them, cried,
"Were Master Lyot here to see your woman-like howling, he would cane the lot of you to death. and I dare say that he would find no objection from me." With that, Elizabeth left them and met the unmentionable Helfords in battle. As she began to take their heads and open their bellies, the other sisters continued to wail. This had the effect of making Lizzie all the angrier and all the more cruel in her slaying of the family. In little more than a minute's time, 11 of the former Helfords lay in the snow, halved and headless and still. Only Missy remained staggering about the lawn with her songbook. Elizabeth presently cut off both of Missy's legs. The creature wailed as it fell onto its front and began clawing its way over ground. Elizabeth next took its arms, rendering the creature unable to move at all, its face buried in the snow. She then returned the dagger to Kitty, retrieved her 3-barreled musket, and made for the house, leaving her sobbing sisters behind.
"Are you to leave poor Missy thus?" asked Jane.
"If none of you possesses the fortitude to finish her, you can watch her freeze," said Elizabeth, before disappearing into the house.
The gardeners stayed a week at Longbourn. Mrs. Bennet had so carefully provided for the entertainment of her brother and sister that they did not once sit down to a family dinner. When the engagement was for home, some of the officers always made part of it, of which Mr. Wickham was sure to be one. And on these occasions, Mrs. Gardiner, rendered suspicious by Elizabeth's warm commendation, narrowly observed them both. Their preference of each other was plain enough to make her a little uneasy, and she resolved to speak to Elizabeth on the subject before leaving Hertfordshire. To Mrs. Gardiner, Wickham had one means of affording pleasure, unconnected with his general powers. About 10 or 12 years ago, before her marriage, she had spent a considerable time in that very part of Derbyshire to which he belonged. They had, therefore, many acquaintances in common. And though Wickham had been there little since the death of Darcy's father, it was yet in his power to give her fresher intelligence of her former friends than she had been in the way of procuring. Mrs. Gardiner had seen Mr. Darcy's estate, Pemberley, and known the late Mr. Darcy by his reputation as a gentleman and powerful slayer of the undead. Here, consequently, was an inexhaustible subject of discourse. On being made acquainted with the present Mr. Darcy's treatment of him, she tried to remember some of that gentleman's reputed disposition, and was confident that she recollected having heard Mr. Fitzwilliam Darcy formerly spoken of as a very proud, ill-natured boy. Chapter 26 Mrs. Gardiner's caution to Elizabeth was punctually and kindly given on the first favourable opportunity of speaking to her alone. After honestly telling her what she thought, she thus went on. "You are too sensible a girl, Lizzie, to fall in love merely because you are warned against it, and therefore I am not afraid of speaking openly. Seriously, I would have you be on your guard. I have nothing to say against him. He has felled many a zombie, and if he had the fortune he ought to have, I should think you could not do better. But as it is, you must not let your fancy run away with you." "My dear aunt, this is being serious indeed." "Yes, and I hope to engage you to be serious likewise." "Well, then, you need not be under any alarm. I will take care of myself, and of Mr. Wickham, too. He shall not be in love with me if I can prevent it." "Elizabeth, you are not serious now." "I beg your pardon. I will try again. I am a warrior, madam, survivor of the 36 chambers of Shaolin, beholder of the scrolls of Ganshin Tang. I do not seek love, and at present I am not in love with Mr. Wickham, though he is, beyond all comparison, the most agreeable man I ever saw, in form, character, and musketry. However, I see the imprudence of an attachment with one so deeply in want of fortune. I will not be in a hurry to believe myself his first object. When I am in company with him, I will not be wishing. In short, I will do my best. Perhaps it will be as well if you discourage his coming here so very often. At least you should not remind your mother of inviting him. You know my mother's ideas as to the necessity of constant company for her friends. But really, and upon my honour, I will try to do what you think to be the wisest. And now, I hope you are satisfied." Her aunt assured her that she was, and Elizabeth, having thanked her for the kindness of her hints, they parted. A wonderful instance of advice being given on such a point without being resented. Mr. Collins returned into Hertfordshire soon after it had been quitted by the Gardiners and Jane, but as he took up his abode with the Lucases, his arrival was no great inconvenience to Mrs. Bennet. His marriage was now fast approaching, and she was at length so far resigned as to think it inevitable, and even repeatedly to say, in an ill-natured tone, that she wished they might be happy. Thursday was to be the wedding day, and on Wednesday Miss Lucas paid her farewell visit, and when she rose to take leave, Elizabeth, ashamed of her mother's ungracious and reluctant good wishes, and sincerely affected herself, accompanied her out of the room. As they went downstairs together, Charlotte said,
"I promise to write for as long as I am able. I shall depend on hearing from you very often, Eliza."
"That you certainly shall. We shall often meet, I hope, in Hertfordshire."
"I am not likely to leave Kent for some time. Promise me, therefore, to come to Hunsford."
Elizabeth could not refuse, though she foresaw little pleasure in the visit. Charlotte was already showing the earliest signs of transformation, though she took great care to hide them from all but the trained eye. Her skin had taken on a slight pallor, and her speech seemed a trifle laboured.
"My father and Maria are coming to me in March," added Charlotte, "and I hope you will consent to be of the party. Indeed, Eliza, you will be as welcome as either of them."
The wedding took place, and no one other than Elizabeth seemed to suspect the bride's condition. Mr. Collins appeared happier than he ever had, despite the fact that Charlotte had to be reminded to use her fork several times over the course of dinner. The bride and bridegroom set off for Kent from the church door, and everybody had as much to say or to hear on the subject as usual. Elizabeth soon heard from her friend, and their correspondence was as regular and frequent as it had ever been. That it should be equally affectionate was impossible. Charlotte's first letters were received with a good deal of eagerness. There could not but be curiosity to know how she would speak of her new home, how she would like Lady Catherine, and how her transformation was proceeding. The house, furniture, neighbourhood, and roads were all to her taste, and Lady Catherine's behaviour was most friendly and obliging. It was Mr. Collins's picture of Hunsford and Rosings rationally softened, and Elizabeth perceived that she must wait for her own visit there to know the rest. The only harbinger of Charlotte's unhappy fate was her ever-worsening penmanship. Jane had already written a few lines to her sister to announce their safe arrival in London, and when she wrote again, Elizabeth hoped it would be in her power to say something of the Bingleys. Her impatience for this second letter was as well rewarded as impatience generally is. Jane had been a week in town without either seeing or hearing from Caroline. She accounted for it, however, by supposing that her last letter to her friend from Longbourn had, by some accident, been lost. "My aunt," she continued, "is going tomorrow into that part of the town, and I shall take the opportunity of calling in Section 4 Central." She wrote again when the visit was paid and she had seen Miss Bingley. "I did not think Caroline in spirits," were her words, "but she was very glad to see me, and reproached me for giving her no notice of my coming to London. I was right, therefore. My last letter had never reached her. I inquired after their brother, of course. He was well, but so much engaged with Mr. Darcy that they scarcely ever saw him. I found that Miss Darcy was expected to dinner. I wish I could see her. My visit was not long, as Caroline and Mrs. Hurst were going out. I dare say I shall see them soon here." Elizabeth shook her head over this letter. Jane was a fine killer, but a deficient judge of character. Indeed, her only weakness was her too-giving heart. Elizabeth was quite convinced that Caroline Bingley had no intentions of telling her brother about the visit, or even Jane's being in town. Once again, her thoughts turned to the satisfaction of seeing Miss Bingley's last rubies pour from her neck and down the front of her bodice. As she predicted, 4 weeks passed away, and Jane saw nothing of him. She endeavoured to persuade herself that she did not regret it, but she could no longer be blind to Miss Bingley's inattention. After waiting at home every morning for a fortnight, the visitor did at last appear, but the shortness of her stay and the alteration of her manner would allow Jane to deceive herself no longer. The letter which she wrote to her sister will prove what she felt.
"My dearest Lizzie, you will, I am sure, be incapable of triumphing in your better judgment at my expense when I confess myself to have been entirely deceived in Miss Bingley's regard for me. But, my dear sister, though the event has proved you right, do not think me obstinate if I still assert that my confidence was as natural as your suspicion. Caroline did not return my visit till yesterday, and not a note, not a line did I receive in the meantime. When she did come, it was very evident that she had no pleasure in it. She made a slight, formal apology for not calling before, said not a word of wishing to see me again, and was in every respect so altered a creature that when she went away I was perfectly resolved to follow her into the street and confront her as you suggested, and had I been appropriately dressed for an outing, I might have. He knows of my being in town, I am certain, from something she said herself, and yet it would seem, by her manner of talking, as if she wanted to persuade herself that he is really partial to Miss Darcy. I cannot understand it. If I were not afraid of judging harshly, I should be almost tempted to demand satisfaction. But I will endeavour to banish every painful thought, and think only of what will make me happy, your affection, and the invariable kindness of my dear uncle and aunt. Let me hear from you very soon. Miss Bingley said something of his never returning to Netherfield again, of giving up the house, but not with any certainty. We had better not mention it. I am extremely glad that you have such pleasant accounts from our friends at Hunsford. Pray go to see them with Sir William and Maria. I am sure you will be very comfortable there. Yours, etc. This letter gave Elizabeth some pain, but her spirits returned as she considered that Jane would no longer be duped, and that her focus might once again turn to combat. All expectation from the brother was now absolutely over. She would not even wish for a renewal of his attentions. His character sunk on every review of it, and as a punishment for him, as well as a possible advantage to Jane, she seriously hoped he might really soon marry Mr. Darcy's sister, as, by Wickham's account, she would make him abundantly regret what he had thrown away. Mrs. Gardiner, about this time, wrote and reminded Elizabeth of her promise concerning that gentleman, and required information. Elizabeth assured her that his apparent partiality had subsided, his attentions were over, he was the admirer of someone else. The sudden acquisition of £10,000 was the most remarkable charm of the young lady to whom he was now rendering himself agreeable. But Elizabeth, less clear-sighted perhaps in this case than in Charlotte's, did not quarrel with him for his wish of independence. Nothing, on the contrary, could be more natural, and while able to suppose that it cost him a few struggles to relinquish her, she was ready to allow it a wise and desirable measure for both, and could very sincerely wish him happy. All this was acknowledged to Mrs. Gardiner, and after relating the circumstances, she thus went on. "I am now convinced, my dear aunt, that I have never been much in love, for had I really experienced that pure and elevating passion, I should at present detest his very name and wish him all manner of evil. But I find my thoughts returning to the protection of our beloved England, for truly there can be no higher purpose. Indeed, the feelings of one young lady seem rather insignificant in comparison." My talents and my times demand my service, and I believe the crown more pleased to have me on the front lines than at the altar. Chapter 27. With no greater events than these in the Longbourn family, and otherwise diversified by little beyond the walks to Meryton, less often interrupted by zombies on account of the hardened earth of winter, did January and February pass away. March was to take Elizabeth to Hunsford. She had not at first thought very seriously of going thither, but Charlotte, she soon found, was struggling to keep the last of her senses, and Elizabeth thought it an appropriate tribute to their former friendship to see her one last